From the studios of Central Coast Public Radio, KUSP, in Santa Cruz, California, I'm Gary Shapiro, and this is From the Bookshelf. Author and humorist Roy Blunt Jr. is my guest this week. His newest book is called Alphabet Juice. The New York Times called it Roy Blunt Jr.'s personal lexicon, usage manual, writer's guidebook, etymological investigation, and literary junk drawer. You know Roy Blunt from his appearances here on NPR's Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me. And it's certainly a pleasure to say, Roy Blunt Jr., welcome to From the Bookshelf.
Hey, Gary. How you doing?
Good. Thank you. So, what is it about language that delights you so?
Well, since I'm responding to that in language, it's hard to get outside language to talk about language, but, my mother taught me to read phonetically before I went off to school, which gave me a certain advantage, but also marked me forever. Trying to be phonetic, sound out the words in English is a tricky proposition because English is such a confusing and inconsistent language, but it also gets you into lots of sensuous pleasures, which I still persist in. And I love the sound of words and the sound of letters, and love the whole comical notion of capturing the sounds of words and letters on the printed page with little squiggles of ink.
So is this a book that you've always wanted to write? You've dreamed of writing this book, or did it just occur to you?
No, it is a book that I have been, I'm not exaggerating when I say it's a book I've been sort of writing since high school. I've been making notes to myself in little notebooks and big notebooks for many, many years, and thinking that I would love to write a book about language and words and how to use them, or how they are used. When I was in high school, I had a great 10th grade English teacher who introduced me to, among other things, the Strunk and White book.
Elements of Style.
Elements of Style, which was a kind of nice, I grew up in a religious but also mercantile family, which, had all sorts of normative standards that I respected but did not feel all that comfortable with. But I loved books about how to use words. And also, my mother, as I think I said before, taught me to read early and to read in a kind of read for pleasure. My family's notions of permissible, I don't want to overstate this point, but my family's notions of permissible pleasures were limited. You were supposed to enjoy food. You were free to enjoy food and some other things, and also words. You were free to enjoy words up to a point. There were some words you shouldn't enjoy. But at any rate, it tapped into to read about language and the pleasures of language and also strictures with regard to language was bracing and liberating to me at the same time. And I sort of moved from a religious perspective to a linguistic perspective and a secular linguistic perspective that still sustains me.
Well, English is my only language, but it is a particularly funny language. I had a Spanish teacher who told me it was a very difficult language, and she cited that we chop down a tree and then we chop it up.
There you go. Chop it down, chop it up. Yeah, it's a very inconsistent language, and it's a language that reflects the inconsistencies of human existence. But it also reflects the influences that come in, that have come in from so many angles. I'm sorry. It's the most welcoming language in the world. It takes in influences from Yiddish to Shoshone, and it's this huge, bizarre, lumpy mixture of things, and I've always liked miscellaneity. You know, e pluribus unum is a thing to strive for, and it's a thing that you can strive for in English, which is full of lots of pluribus, and I find that very congenial as opposed to a tight. Supposedly, I mean, I haven't counted them, but I've read that there are three times as many words in English as there are in any other language, and I think that, and also, of course, English is an imperialistic language in lots of ways, and it dominates the rest of the world. So it's a strong thing, and it's also, so to deal in English is both a responsibility and a great privilege.
Well, I guess there are both a zillion words that mean the same thing in English, and then I guess there's a word that you can use to mean so many other things. In your book, you mentioned scratch. I think that's the one that has the most different meanings in your book. Do you think that's the word that has the most different meanings in English?
Oh, no, there's also bust.
Oh.
Bust has a lot of different meanings. Yeah, and you know why those words have so many different meanings is that they're fun to say. A big theme of my book is that language is an oral and physical thing, that all English is body English at some level, that language is not an abstract proposition, but something that issues from the body. And it's fun to say scratch, and scratch, expresses all, scratch expresses, there's a difference between itch and scratch. Itch calls out for scratch, it seems to me. But at any rate, scratch sounds like what it means, and therefore, by my standards, is a sonic-y word, a word that whose sound and whose kinesthetic properties, as it issues from the human body, evoke. And now I've lost track of the whether I have a plural or a singular verb, but there's a subject. I believe it's a plural subject, so I'm going to say evoke the meaning of the word. Scratch is scratch. And not only does it fit the word to actually rake yourself with your fingers, but it sort of evokes something kind of unpleasant and grating, and therefore has been used to mean the devil, and has been used to mean the line that you draw in the dirt to, like a scrimmage line, zero-based consideration that we refer to when we say starting from scratch. It's the first thing that a baby chick does is to scratch in the dirt, and then it takes off.
We're speaking with Roy Blunt, Jr., and his new book is called Alphabet Juice, and we felt bad for him because, wait, don't tell me he's only on twice a week here, so we know you need more air time, so we brought you on from the bookshelf. But your book a couple of times reminded me a little bit of Edwin Newman. You remember Edwin Newman?
Yeah, I remember Edwin Newman.
He did that sort of thing where he was very annoyed with the way people were speaking and misusing language.
Right.
Does it bother you when you're reading the newspaper, watching TV? Do you go fly into a rage when you hear?
Things do annoy me. Things like people who misuse, who use the word disinterested to mean uninterested. And people who, I have lots of peeves. But every time I start thinking about my peeves, I think about how much I love the word peeve. So I like to have a more positive message, which is there are lots of wonderful, relishable words in the language. And but I do have, I like to hear, there's this, people speak of descriptive and prescriptive considerations of language, and nobody believes in prescriptive anymore, I don't think, except the people. I mean, whenever I talk about this book, people arise to tell me the words they hate. Words like snuck. They tell me they hate the word snuck. It's like the S-N word. And I actually kind of like the word snuck.
He snuck into the movie rather than he sneaked in?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. It seems, I'm not bothered by that. But people love to talk about how stupid other stupidly other people use language, and I'm not immune to that temptation, but I'll try to concentrate more on enthusiasm for the energies and powers of letters and sounds, hence the title of my book, Alphabet Juice.
So you're not quite the Edwin Newman of our
time.
Well,
I'm trying to remember this exactly, but I remember hearing somebody say, this should appeal to every human. And I thought, why would it appeal to every human? Then I realized he was saying Edwin Newman. Or maybe it was the other way around. I don't remember. At any rate, I thought Edwin Newman was a little bit stuffy about it. You know, there are lots of people who say, who hold up standards of how words ought to be used, and I salute them, but, you know, they're constantly being swept away by the waves of new usage, and so I would like to have it both ways. And you can't prescribe anymore. You can't say people have to do this. People ought to say this. What I do feel I have a certain franchise of is over the counter. I can't prescribe, but since I have been dealing in words for a long time, I feel I do have some standing to say there are better ways to use words than that.
I guess we have to give up, you know, like at the end of the sentence, because now, you know, every single person does it. I hear it on the radio and everything else. You know, where are you at? Where's he at?
Where's he at? Well, that's not too elegant.
No.
You want to say, where is he, probably. Where is he at is a little... But that kind of thing doesn't bother me as much as things that obscure, like using the word... Everybody now, almost everybody, uses the expression begs the question wrong, based on its traditional meaning. Traditionally, it meant to assume what was to be proven, which is like saying, have you stopped beating your wife? That was a classic begging the question, which is, you know, the question itself lays the answer upon you, and you have to sort of talk your way out of it. And lots of that goes on, but people now use the expression begs the question to mean it raises the question or it urges the question. So you can no longer use it in its traditional sense unless you're in a tiny academic community that clings to it.
Well, I'm a middle school teacher, and so I hear a lot of misused words all the time. But one word that I think is pretty interesting, and it's been going on for a long time now, so maybe it's just changed its meaning, is the word barely. I was in the cafeteria, and I said, oh, these cookies smell good. And this girl said, yeah, we barely made these.
Oh, that's interesting. Like we just recently, just this moment, made them.
Right, or you know, why were you late? I barely got here.
Well, that's interesting.
They think that it means the same as just.
Yeah, yeah.
But
well,
it doesn't exactly.
Just barely, yeah. Just barely made it. I mean, I can have heard that. You know, I just barely made it. But we just barely made these cookies. It's strange. Just barely made it is sort of like. Within a hair's breadth or something, I don't know.
Yeah, no, it's kind of lost.
Well, children certainly change. I first heard the expression diss, as it's to diss someone.
Right.
From the lips of a, you know, a school child like 20 years ago. And so if you want to know where the language is heading, you need to listen to kids as well as to tell them to stop it.
You know, the various words they have to mean something is really good, like tight. That's tight.
Right, yeah.
Yeah.
Or, well, now, okay, how about the word random?
Yeah, that's random.
Random. Doesn't that mean, I thought that was sort of an all-purpose pejorative among young people today, but then...
I think it means it's a non sequitur. That was random.
Yeah, so, I mean, that's just sort of off the wall or something. So, weird.
Yeah.
I don't know.
But eight don't annoy you at all.
Eight?
Eight.
Oh, eight. No, I like eight. Eight was proper in, you know, was standard in the 18th century, and then the Victorians came along and and rendered it improper. But it's the only contraction of am not in language, and you wouldn't want Fats Waller to have sung am misbehaving. It's a great word in song titles, and I guess you can't, you shouldn't use it if you're applying for a job, but unless it's a nice, loose kind of job that I would like to have. But it's a good, strong word, and it has a real tang to it, and I like it.
Well, I'm going to tell people that you told me I could use it. So.
Yeah, I'll send you, I'll give you an excuse from your parents.
Thanks. So, do you find it less or more annoying when you hear poor grammar on the radio or television than when you read it?
Well, that's an interesting question. I guess there's less excuse for it in writing, but it's more influential on the air and on television. So, you know, people in speech have some license to be looser than they are in writing, but I cringe every time I hear words used like when people use the word literally to mean figuratively, as the economy is literally going into the toilet.
Not really doing that.
No, it's not going to go in the toilet. It can't. It's,
won't fit.
Right, it's too big. It may yet shrink to the point where it would go into a very big toilet, but even so, it wouldn't be literal. So, you know, and that's more influential, but there's no excuse for using literally wrong in print, because print is all about literally, or should be. But people do use it wrong in print.
Well, your book, and the book is called Alphabet Juice, it's kind of almost like a lot of little found poems, the way you go through all these words, and there's a certain musical quality to the book, and you play in a band. You have a rock band.
Well, to say I play in it and to say I have it, in both cases, that is an overstatement.
You are affiliated with a rock band.
I'm an original member of the Rock Bottom Remainders, but my main role is to introduce them and then to sort of mill around in the background and do a little eccentric dancing and then come in and deliver, you know, sing in the background and also to have a solo on the song Wild Thing. I come in with You Move Me.
That's your big moment?
That's it. Yeah. Sometimes I come in the right time, sometimes not. But
does the band ever rehearse or...?
Yeah, they do.
But you're not there.
The musicians do. Not very much. They don't rehearse very much. But they, we're a very friendly group, and we've been. It was started out as a joke, and somehow or another, the joke has sustained itself now for, I don't know, 20 years maybe. So we keep. We just performed in Miami recently, and people keep wanting us to show up again. And we have a few. Most of the people in the band are pretty musical, and. Or have played in bands before, but we're all, except for a couple of ringers. We have a saxophone player and a drummer. If you say I speak to the public now, and I say, if you're farmers and you want to start a farmers band, or you're plumbers and want to start a plumbers band, I wish you well, but I would recommend that you get a professional saxophone player and a professional drummer, and then you can organize around that. That's what we have done as authors.
That's the secret of your success.
Yeah.
Well, what kind of music do you enjoy? Are you a music person?
Well, yeah. I mean, I like. I'm not a musicologist, but I like. I love the blues and old country music, not contemporary country music. I despise the sort of music that one hears on American Idol. That sort of constant. Ecstatic, huge sort of big whoopee repeating over and over the same chorus. I can't stand.
Over-singing.
Huh?
It's the over-singing that you don't like.
The over-singing and the underwriting. I know it's really retro of me, but I like songs that have several different courses. I mean, several different verses, and then courses which are, you know, come in between the verses. But that's asking too much, I guess. But I like, I like rootsy music, blues, country, early jazz, and I'm very fond of that music. I'm not fond of much music that's made today, but it's hard, I think, to come up with a new, I mean, there's so many fusion sort of attempts to bring together lots of different kinds of music and layer them on top of each other. People are exposed to so many different kinds of music now that it's hard to come up with anything that, I don't know. I just like a tune, and I like somebody with a hoarse voice who came up off the farm delivering something sincere. But also, I admire people. I spent a lot of time in New Orleans, and there's a great New Orleans tradition. Louis Armstrong and Louis Prima of playing for the people, you know, playing great music that's technically really good, but also playing for entertainment and satisfying your own aesthetic principles and an audience's at the same time. So I go back to those guys, and I leave it to younger people to enjoy the music that is coming out today. I don't think anybody really, well, with some exceptions. I mean, I like a few musicians who are younger than I am, but I don't really think most people enjoy popular music recorded by people more than, let's say, 10 years younger than they are.
Oh, that's it. It's your rule of thumb. You believe this is to be true.
Well, I've just noticed it. I haven't found anybody who keeps track of popular music after a certain number of years. And I certainly, you know, I like a little. I've heard some hip hop that I liked.
Yeah.
But I don't. You know.
You're not going to run out to the show.
No, I'm not. I don't look for it.
Yeah. Well, it does seem that most people kind of love the music that they grew up with, I guess.
Yeah. Yeah, you love music you heard in high school, and then further back music, which are the classics that the music you heard in high school was a faint reflection of, which is, say, the blues and you know, rootsy stuff.
Yeah. Well, we're speaking with Roy Blunt Jr., and his new book is called Alphabet Juice. And every once in a while in your book, you linger on an interesting personality, and I like it when you do that. You talked about Yogi Berra a bit, and Mel Blanc. I liked it when you told that little story about Mel Blanc.
Yeah, when he was... Mel Blanc, who was the voice of Bugs Bunny, among other cartoon characters. I forgot what he had a concussion or something. He was in a coma in the hospital, and when they asked him questions as Mel, he wouldn't respond, but when they asked him questions as Bugs, he would respond in Bugs Bunny's voice.
Interesting.
And finally he came out of it. I met him once briefly, and I was struck dumb. Every now and then I'm struck dumb by meeting someone. And actually, I just said the other day there were two people I've been struck dumb by meeting of, and they were Jack Benny and Alice Munro. And I just happened to bump into them accidentally, and I thought, jaw dropped open. But the other one was Mel Blanc, come to think of it, because I'd heard him so many different voices. He used to be on the, I'm going way back now, on the Jack Benny show.
Mr.
Kitzel and all these people. You're right.
Yeah, he was
my childhood,
the sound of Jack Benny's car and all that.
That's right. Yeah, he could do anything. He could speak any voice. He had Mr. Kitzel who would say, hoo-hoo, Mr. Benny. I don't know.
and Yogi Berra, you're fond of him.
I love Yogi Berra, yeah. I wrote a story about him for Sports Illustrated, in which I tried to trace back. You know, he's famously credited with all sorts of Berra-isms, many of which he clearly did not say. But I really tried hard to get him to say which ones he's, you know,
to take credit for some of them or not. Or
yeah, and he's one thing I found. Was that he didn't say that place, nobody goes there anymore, it's too crowded, because I found that in the New Yorker. I happened to find it in the New Yorker in something written by John McNulty back in 1942, I think, when Yogi was still in the Navy, so it was before he was anywhere near quotable. And so I said, here's one thing, Yogi, that I know you didn't say. And he said, oh, yeah, I said that one. So, I don't know. But he says, every now and then I say one, and my kids say, oh, you said one, but I don't know what I said.
Well, we're speaking with Roy Blunt, Jr., and his new book is called Alphabet Juice, and it's a marvelous book, and congratulations. It's gotten very good reviews. And
thank you, Gary. You
can add it to your library of wonderful books by Roy Blunt, Jr. This is book number 21, I believe.
Yep, number 21. It's a lucky number. I'm really fond of this book. I always wanted to write something like this, and I'm pleased to have done it.
Well, before I let you go, just give us a little insight into Wait, Don't Tell Me, because we have a lot of fans here on the show. When you do the show, are you actually there, or you're sitting somewhere else, or what?
Originally, we were all sitting in various locations, various studios, and I actually did it from my house. They gave me earphones and a special connection. But now, the last few years, we've done it in front of a live audience, and usually in Chicago. Sometimes we go to another venue and do it there in front of a live audience to raise money for that local station. But and it's much more fun to have a live audience and to all be sitting there together and looking at each other. We all get along, and it's more fun once you get there. But the commute is tough to fly into O'Hare and then get in from O'Hare to Chicago and then come back the next day. I'm tired of traveling, but that's not anybody else's problem.
Was that something you always thought, oh, I'll be a quiz show?
Well, you know, I used to watch, when I was a kid, I used to watch What's My Line, which was, mm-hmm. I know I'm getting retro now, but there were Dorothy Kilgallen and Bennett Cerf and Steve Allen. They would, it was a quiz show, on TV.
Yeah.
And I always wanted to be in something like that, and then Wait, Don't Tell Me arose, and it's a lot better show than What's My Line ever was. And people, it's been the most popular thing I've ever been involved in.
More people know you from that than everything.
Yeah, I'm afraid so. I mean, it's okay that they know me from that, but I would rather they, read my books. But because when I run into people who have heard my voice on the radio, they sort of look at me as if I don't look like I ought to, and sometimes they even argue with me.
You're not him.
Yeah. Are you sure you look like that?
Well, Roy Blunt, Jr., thank you so much for spending some time with us.
Thank you, Gary. Enjoyed it.
That's all for this week's From the Bookshelf. Hope you enjoyed the show. I'll be back again soon with another great program. Check out our podcast page at kusp.org for some other From the Bookshelf programs. Thanks, as always, to our From the Bookshelf staff, Miss Breanne Beal, for all of her help. Thanks, Breanne. For KUSP, I'm Gary Shapiro. Good night, everybody.